Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is planet Earth a rare treasure within the universe? It's everything to us, of course, the only place we know of that is capable of sustaining the myriad life forms that thrive here. Yet since Copernicus dared to suggest that Earth is not at the center of the universe, we've wondered about how special our watery globe is in the grand scheme of things, and whether there might be other worlds capable of spawning living organisms. Until we can travel quickly and easily through deep space, we will have to content ourselves with gleaning information and making guesses from distant observations. And as my guest will explain, scientists are beginning to understand that Earth benefits from being in the right place at the right time. Caleb Scharf is director of astrobiology at Columbia University. His new book is called The Copernicus Complex, Our Cosmic Significance in a Universe of Planets and Probabilities. Caleb, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Let's begin at the beginning. Before Copernicus, every society we know of just assumed that Earth was at the center of the universe. What observations caused him to start thinking this might not be true?
Copernicus really stood on a body of work that had actually been there for at least a couple of thousand years. The interesting thing is, if you look back at the ancient Greeks, some of the ancient Greeks had already begun to question this dogma that the Earth was completely central to existence. And so Copernicus was intrigued by the problems of explaining the motions of the sun and the moon and the planets and the stars in the night sky. And this is really what prompted him and others as well to think more seriously about what's going on. What is the actual mechanics behind the motion of objects that we see? And that's what led him to propose a so-called heliocentric system. And he really applied the tools of modern science to this problem in a way that no one had quite done before. So he was prompted by observation of nature. And he was also prompted by, I think, it must have been a suspicion that there was something a little contrived about this idea of the Earth being central to all existence.
And so when he guessed correctly that the planets revolve around the sun, he got a few things wrong, obviously, the shape of the orbits, for one thing. But this changed a lot of things. It upset a lot of people, certainly, but it also changed the way many people were thinking about the nature of the universe.
Very much so. And the interesting thing about it is that although his thinking, his ideas about a sun-centered solar system and therefore that the Earth was not central to the universe as a whole, it wasn't entirely met with disgust and skepticism. It was a sort of a seed for a revolution that grew rapidly over the decades and centuries after him. And what it really brought to bear was this idea that if we're not special or central, then that kind of means that there has to be lots of other stuff out there like us. If we are truly inconsequential, then the existence of life here and the existence of human beings surely can't be the only instance of such a phenomenon. So it prompted what was called, I guess you'd call it pluralism, the idea of a multitude of other worlds out there. That's an idea that's stuck with us ever since.
On the other side of that idea is something called the anthropic principle, which is the idea that intelligent life such as we find here on Earth requires so many things to go right that it is, in fact, quite rare, quite special, may not be in a lot of places in the universe.
Yes, so the anthropic principle is very interesting, and this is something that really came up in the last few decades of last century and the 20th century, when physicists began to realize that if you altered a few of the fundamental characteristics of the universe, for example, the relative strength of gravitational forces to electromagnetic forces, you could essentially subvert what follows. You could change, for example, whether or not stars are made in the universe. And stars are critical because, for life at least, because stars produce heavy elements like carbon. We're made of carbon. We're carbon based organisms. And what's interesting about that is if this is the only universe and will only ever be their own universe, why would it turn out seemingly tuned to produce life? Because if you changed a few other things, you changed, for example, the nature of what might have happened in the very early universe around the time of the Big Bang, you would also completely alter what happened in subsequent 13.8 billion years and conceivably not produce the environments for life or life itself. And so this made physicists consider the possibility that there's actually something special about life, that it's telling us something, the existence of life is telling us something about the nature of the universe. And that's really a sort of opposing viewpoint to this idea of that came from Copernicus, ultimately, of cosmic mediocrity. That life is just one of those things. It just happens. And of course, this has become, the anthropic principle is tied up with much more modern ideas of a multiverse. Possibility that this is just one universe. And there are an unbelievable number of other potential universes in separated from us in space, time, or dimension that have different properties. And we just happen to be in one of the universes that's good for life. We're in a sort of particularly fertile desert island, if you will. And that kind of gets around this problem. It says, once again, we're not special. So it sort of saves the Copernican principle, the idea of a multiverse.
Does it matter? I mean, does it interfere with our ability to do the science well that we are biased to be really excited about life? I mean, we can talk about, you know, supernovas and quarks and black holes and whatever else is out there, but life is the one thing that really gets us going.
That's an excellent point. I think you're right. I think this is one of the challenges, is that we would like to understand what life is, and we'd like to understand not just whether or not there's anyone else out there in the universe sitting in a radio station having this conversation, but whether or not there are many such examples. How rare is life? How common is it? How fertile is the cosmos? But to really address those questions, we have to look past our blinkered view on things, because you're absolutely right. Who says that life is an important phenomenon? Well, we do. And it's because it's about us. So we have this, we've had this conflict, I think, this internal conflict almost since ever, and certainly since Copernicus kind of set us free and said, well, you know, we're probably just mediocre, we're not significant, the universe has no true center, and we're just a tiny crumb on a crumb floating around another crumb. But that really sort of is counter to our intuition. You know, I know what I'm like. I get up in the morning and I'm thinking about myself. and as a species, we tend to follow that track. Now, in science, that's difficult, because in science you want to be subjective. But this is one of those problems where it's really difficult to peer past our innate biases to understand, well, what's really important and how do we tackle these questions of our cosmic significance?
So we do have one fantastic example of the kind of planet that can spawn life. How much do we know about how unique or common our sun and solar system are?
This is something that is really at the forefront of science now. 20 years ago, we didn't even know whether there are any other planets around other stars anywhere else in the universe, which seems ludicrous. But it turns out that it's extremely difficult to see planets or to detect the presence of planets. So it's really only been in the last 20 years that astronomers have built instruments of the necessary sensitivity to do this. And what we've discovered is there's lots of planets. Our galaxy, the Milky Way, just makes planets in abundance. There are more planets than stars. And on the one hand, that's terrific news in terms of the idea of Copernican mediocrity, that there are lots of other solar systems out there. But we've also discovered that planets are extraordinarily diverse, and the configurations of these systems are very diverse, so much so that it's starting to look like our solar system, it may not be incredibly rare, but it's somewhat unusual. The type of star that we orbit is rather larger than the majority of stars. The configuration of our orbits, they're rather more circular and spread out than most planetary systems. And the types of planets in our solar system, there are planetary types out there we'd never seen before. And in fact, some of them are very common, but we don't have them. For example, there are things called super-Earths, which are a little more massive than the Earth, but not as big as Neptune. And some 60% of planetary systems have one of those, but we don't. So the interesting thing, and really the challenge as well, is to understand whether that degree of unusualness of our solar system is somehow connected to the existence of life here. It's tempting to think that it might be, but we don't quite yet know how to make that connection.
We are in a good position in our solar system, close enough to the sun that we have liquid water. But it turns out that proximity to a star isn't the only way that a planet or a moon might be warm enough to have liquid water.
Absolutely right. One of the other things we've realized, both by looking at our own solar system in more detail, but also looking at these other planetary systems, is that some of the criteria that we've assumed give rise to a beautiful planet with oceans and tropical beaches and so on may not apply everywhere. So there may be opportunities, for example, where you can keep a planet warm enough for life, not by the light of the star, not by the radiation of the star, but by tidal effects, by gravitational tides that knead and distort the material of the planet in such a way that they actually keep it warm. And we think an example of that phenomena may be happening in the moon Europa around Jupiter, which probably contains an enormous ocean of liquid water beneath the surface. And this is a radically different sort of habitat. But it's possible that that's a more common type of habitat, or rather a place that could potentially have life, than the Earth itself. So the most recent science has really begun to turn over some of our preconceptions and our assumptions.
And of course, we still don't know how life made its way to Earth or spontaneously generated itself on Earth. So we're at a real disadvantage here in trying to understand how it might be on other planets.
That's right. This is all intimately connected with the question of origins, of the origins of life here on Earth. And there are a number of things we can do about this. So, for example, our exploration of our own solar system is a critical piece of this. And we can go and look on Mars to see whether or not life exists or has existed there. And we can look in places like Europa. The intriguing thing about that is it might be life from the same stock as us, because our solar system is kind of a messy place. And over billions of years, pieces of material have been chipped off planets when asteroids hit them and essentially exchanged. So we can find pieces of Mars on Earth, Martian meteorites, and we assume we can find pieces of Earth on Mars, and they could conceivably carry microorganisms. So it doesn't necessarily give us the solution to origins, but finding, if we could find an example of life elsewhere in our solar system that was clearly distinct, that really didn't have a common ancestry, that would be a clue. It would give us a clue to the sorts of environments that can generate life.
My guest is Caleb Scharf. He is director of astrobiology at Columbia University and author of the new book, The Copernicus Complex, Our Cosmic Significance in a Universe of Planets and Probabilities. You can join this conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Caleb Scharf, who is Director of Astrobiology at Columbia University and author of The Copernicus Complex, Our Cosmic Significance in a Universe of Planets and Probabilities. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Caleb, going back to what you were saying about the possibility that in our messy solar system, as you call it, there could be a common source of life, common stock of life that has appeared in multiple places. There's a time element here as well, right? Because microorganisms theoretically could survive a journey through space and end up somewhere else and take root. You know, if something were to hit the Earth today, a cow or a turtle or a fish would probably not make it to, you know, Venus.
That's right. Yeah, no cows on Venus. Right. So one of the most extraordinary things that we've also discovered in recent years about the nature of life on Earth, I think if you ask someone 50 or 100 years ago, what's life on Earth? What constitutes the majority of life on Earth? They might say cows and fish and plants and insects and so on. We now know the answer is microbes, single-celled organisms like bacteria and another ancient domain called archaea. These guys are the long-lived creatures. I mean, individually, they're not long-lived, but they've been here since ever. We think that they represent the first type of cellular life that arose on Earth some 4 billion years ago. And they're still here, and they are incredibly entrenched in the planet. And some of them have remarkable survival skills. They live in extreme environments, or environments that we would find to be very difficult, high temperatures, acidic, even high radiation environments. And they're everywhere. So if a chunk of rock gets blasted from the Earth, for example, it's not going to carry a surviving cow. It might carry parts of a cow, but, you know, we won't talk about that. It will absolutely certainly carry microbes, single-celled organisms, and some of those may well be robust enough to survive within a piece of rock in space for an extended period of time, possibly years, decades, even thousands of years, perhaps even longer. We're not entirely sure about that. So it's those organisms that could conceivably jump planet. Pieces of the Earth could end up on Mars and vice versa and carry that kind of life. And if that kind of life then finds itself in an amenable environment, it could flourish. And the interesting thing is that these microbes also carry between them the absolutely central, critical genetic information for metabolism, for the way in which life extracts energy and raw materials from its environment. The microbes are really the guardians of that information. They have been for 4 billion years. So, yeah, so now we've learned that, it means that the potential for cross-contamination or seeding other places in our solar system is pretty high, we think.
Of course, it might have to happen hundreds or thousands or millions of times before something catches. In the same way that if you try to start a fire with a flint and steel, it might take you a long time to get anything to burn.
That's a really good point. I think often we don't focus on that so much. We just say, well, it could happen, therefore. But you're absolutely right. There's nothing to say that it wouldn't take a lot of exchange of material. And it does look like a lot of material has been exchanged between places like Earth and Mars and other environments in the solar system. So, you know, the opportunity is apparently there. The problem is, as interesting as that would be to discover our ancestors on Mars or vice versa, and some people have argued that ancient Mars was conceivably a better environment for the origins of life in the solar system. So we may all be Martians. The one problem with that in terms of understanding our cosmic significance or whether or not we're truly cosmically mediocre or not is that if we all belong to the same stock, it only still gives us that one piece of information about how likely it is for life to have occurred here. It's still not telling us how likely it is for life to occur elsewhere, around another star, for example. The best outcome would be if we found essentially alien life elsewhere in the solar system, because it would tell us that whatever the origin process is for life, it happened more than once here. And that gives you improved statistics and a greater probability of it happening elsewhere. So that would be the real, that would be the perfect result.
What kinds of biomarkers do we look for in other parts of the galaxy, other parts of the universe, that would indicate that at least there's a possibility that something resembling what we know to be life might exist?
Well, that really comes back to this idea of essentially microbial life. I mean, that's really where we come back to, although it could include other types of more complex life. But microbes are a good example. They operate at a molecular chemical level, essentially, and they produce a different chemistry around them. They re-engineer their environment. So, for example, the oxygen that we're breathing at the moment, it comes from plants, but why do plants produce oxygen? Well, they produce oxygen because at some point in the distant past, billions of years ago, a microorganism, a microbe, invented a way to take sunlight and power itself with sunlight, but generate oxygen as a byproduct. So we're breathing a biomarker all the time. A biomarker is oxygen. It could also be carbon dioxide and a variety of other compounds. So one of the techniques that astronomers are trying to refine at the moment and apply is to look at essentially the chemical fingerprint of life in the environment of a planet. So if you find a planet that maybe resembles the Earth in some way, you want to probe the chemical composition of its atmosphere and perhaps its surface environment. And we think that we can do that with some very clever techniques using the light that is either reflected from those planets or the light that passes through their atmosphere because of a background star. And these are the tools that, if we're lucky, in the next 10 to 20 years may give us an indication that there are planets that look strange. So life is kind of an out-of-equilibrium phenomenon. It leaves a dirty fingerprint, you know, and we're a good example of this, right? We're dumping CO2 into our atmosphere in a way that is kind of strange compared to more natural phenomena. And also our planet breathes on an annual cycle. The balance of carbon dioxide and oxygen changes with season. So those are the kinds of things we'd look for in other worlds, exoplanets, planets around other stars, something that looks askew, because the phenomena that we know best of that makes things look askew is life.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Chris in Fort Worth. Hi, Chris.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I just had a question. If there are over 100 or so anthropic principles that point to why life is so special on this Earth, does that not give us the idea or option that it possibly points to an intelligent designer?
So people have certainly talked about this notion. And I think the difficulty with that, speaking as a scientist, is that it gives few options for taking the problem further. If we say that, well, you know, is there intelligent, purposeful design behind this? What do we do next? And I think science has a hard time with that. I know I certainly have a hard time with that. And then, of course, it begs the obvious question, well, where did the designer come from? And so then we go off into a different trajectory. I think it's important to address this scientifically. If we ever really run out of options, well, perhaps we can consider other things.
The location of Earth in space is very important in our case, or we believe it's important for the fact that we have such an abundance of life on the planet. You also remind us that our position in time might be a significant factor. Can you tell us a little bit about the development of the universe and how we know that we have come along at a pretty stable moment?
Yes, so this is a very intriguing aspect of our existence, and we can look at it in a number of different ways, but if we look at the history of the cosmos, 13.8 billion years ago, we think there was a Big Bang event. The universe essentially emerged out of that and has been expanding ever since, and in fact, we now think its expansion, the expansion of the very fabric of space itself, is accelerating. And it has been accelerating for several billion years now. And if we also look at the contents of the universe, we see that there are certain periods in cosmic time, especially in the past, where stars were being produced much more vigorously than they are now. And this is looking across not just our galaxy, but all the galaxies that we can survey, essentially looking across what's called the observable universe, so the universe from which light has had time to reach us. So there are a number of really interesting things that come out of this. So, for example, if we look into the future as well, we can see that this continued expansion of the universe will eventually isolate our galaxy. And it will isolate our galaxy in the sense that light from other galaxies will no longer be able to reach us because the universe will have expanded so much. And this is looking maybe 100 billion years into the future. And if we look back into the past, we see that obviously around the time of the Big Bang, there were no stars or planets or anything like that. And then maybe 8 billion years or so ago was this heyday of star formation. It's when the majority of stars in the universe that we see today were formed as gravity coalesced material. And in fact, today we live at a cosmic time where essentially 95% of all the stars that will ever be formed have formed. There's only 5% to go. We're kind of in the beginning of a long twilight, a cosmic twilight. The other facet of this is going back to the future, to 100 billion years in the future, this isolation of our galaxy will make it very difficult. If you're an intelligent being 100 billion years in the future sitting in the Milky Way galaxy, you have a really hard time figuring out cosmology. You have a really hard time working out what the origins of the universe was. And you would probably come up with a different picture than the one we have because you cannot see the expansion of the universe. And you might not be able to figure out that a Big Bang had happened 110 billion years in the past. So where we are in cosmic time is conceivably a special time. It's a time where you can learn about the universe. We think we can get cosmology correct. And of course, we could be deluding ourselves, just like those intelligent creatures 100 billion years in the future who don't have all the necessary information. We also live at this kind of cooling off period in as much as the number of stars being formed. And star formation is kind of a violent process. And some stars go through their fuel very quickly and explode. So along with star formation, you get supernova and exploding stars. So we live in a sort of temperate place in time as well as in space. And that is, again, intriguing. The challenge is, and obviously this is something I discuss at length in my book, is to connect that to our existence. Is there a connection between this cosmic landscape in time and space that we find ourselves in and our existence here? It's very tempting to say that there must be, but it's going to be very hard to finalize that argument until we find other life.
We can't say for certain, of course, what might ultimately extinguish life on Earth. So is it even possible to guess about what the scientific clues are that we might leave behind that would show that life did exist here previously?
Obviously, people have talked about this, about the deep future. Will we be just such a tiny layer in the strata of the rock that it would be hard to deduce our existence? I think it would be relatively straightforward to see, suppose it's 100 billion years from now and the Earth has somehow survived the future history of our sun, which will eventually change and expand and rearrange the solar system. If you came as a future archaeologist, I think you would deduce that life had existed here. You would find chemical signatures. Obviously, there are going to be things like fossils. But you would probably figure out that, yes, something happened here, life happened here. Now, as for humans, that's a different question. We, depending on how long we stick around, we may not have influenced the form of our planet quite as much as we think. Obviously on a day-to-day basis, we're influencing it strongly. On a deep history, deep future timescale, maybe we'll leave a bit of plutonium around or some of these other things that are highly artificial and would survive for that length of time. But yeah, we're a fleeting thing, I think. I think we're a tiny little sliver of a much greater history.
So we might be looking at places that have hosted life in the past and not be able to tell necessarily, even if we're looking straight at them from a very far distance.
That's a terrific point. Absolutely. Yeah. And this is one of the challenges with this science, is stepping back from all that we know about the modern Earth and asking questions, not just about what will the Earth look like in the future, but also what it's looked like in the past. Because it's also true that if you step back in time, let's say 2 billion years, and you looked at the Earth from a distance, it would appear different. There might not be much oxygen in the atmosphere. There's no plant life on the surface. The continents are differently arranged. The chemistry is different. Our star was a different luminosity. It would be fainter. So it's absolutely true. We could find ourselves simply looking out in the cosmos, seeing all these places that look like they ought to be suitable for life, but we can't detect any. And it might be that either we're looking too soon or we're looking too late. So that is another big challenge.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go now to Shahid in Irving. Hi, Shahid.
Hi. Yeah, I just have a quick question, and I've heard this notion spoken by various astrophysicists and also just spoken in this program that the universe is expanding. So what I want to understand is, obviously, the term expanding means that there is something outside the boundaries of our universe where it's expanding towards, right? So what is outside the boundaries of our universe? So I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks, Shahid. Actually, we're going to take a quick break. We will get an answer for you in just a moment from my guest, Caleb Scharf. He is director of astrobiology at Columbia University and author of the new book, The Copernicus Complex, Our Cosmic Significance in a Universe of Planets and Probabilities. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Caleb Scharf, who is director of astrobiology at Columbia University and author of The Copernicus Complex, Our Cosmic Significance in a Universe of Planets and Probabilities. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we heard from Shahid before the break, who wanted to understand, Caleb, into what the universe is expanding.
That's a great question. I'll try to give a very brief answer. And the first is a sort of excuse, because I think it's extremely hard to answer this question in a satisfactory way. The key is to recognize that when we talk about the expansion of the universe, we're actually talking about the expansion of space itself, the very fabric within which we make measurements. And so in that sense, if space itself is expanding, there isn't anything outside it, because there is no space beyond the expanding space itself. The other way to think about it is, our universe could be infinite, but because light travels at a finite speed, we only see what we call the observable universe, which is kind of this bubble around us from which light has had time to reach us. And that, in a sense, is a useful way to consider a useful thing to think of as the edge of the universe, but it's an edge in time. And outside that, we can't yet see, because light hasn't reached us from that edge. So that's my 2-second answer to that question.
Talk a little bit about why carbon is so critical in our search for life forms elsewhere.
Carbon is part of the most ubiquitous chemistry everywhere in the universe. And this is something we've recognized over the last few decades. So carbon chemistry is, of course, our biochemistry. We're made of carbon-based structures. Carbon atoms are really good at making a variety of molecular bonds with other elements and making an extraordinary array of polymer-like molecules. Things end up being DNA or RNA and proteins and the like. And the interesting thing is when we look out in the universe, it doesn't matter whether we're looking at other planets, forming planets, or whether we're just looking at gas in interstellar space. The dominant type of chemistry is carbon chemistry, and it's just everywhere. And it's because stars make a decent amount of carbon, and it gets spewed out into the cosmos, and it can build all these wonderful molecular bonds with other elements. And so this is almost certainly not a coincidence that our chemistry is the same as this sort of universal chemistry set that we see everywhere else.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Lawrence in Dallas. Hi, Lawrence.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment. Your guest seems to represent the majority view, if we can call it that, that the universe is expanding and what have you. I'm sorry to bang on about that, you know, portion of the topic again, but I've become aware that there is a minority view. There's even an author by the last name of Tyson who's written a book that mathematically seems to refute the interpretation of the universe expanding by virtue of, you know, people saying that they know it to be a fact by virtue of the redshift and all this. Anyway, I just wanted to make that comment, and then perhaps also the other comment addressing the previous caller as to what might be outside, and I would just suggest that it may be simply full of Smurfs.
Full of Smurfs. Well, I don't know how much of that you want to comment on, Caleb.
Well, I like the Smurf theory. That's a good one. Yeah, you know, so I think that's a valid point. And this is the nature of science. When we say that we live in an expanding universe, sure, that's the majority opinion. I think at this point, it's a very small minority of scientists who would seriously question the observation of an expanding universe. I think the bigger focus is perhaps on our ignorance of the contents of the universe. So there's a great deal of focus on the nature of this stuff called dark matter that makes up something like 30% of the mass energy content of the universe, and this mysterious thing called dark energy that seems to be driving the accelerating expansion of the universe. You know, science is always able, I think, I hope, to take minority views and allow them, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're correct.
Let me make sure I understand this. You estimate that there is a 95% chance that there is, what, another Earth-like planet within our galactic neighborhood? Is that correct?
Pretty much. So that is a figure based on our understanding of the statistics of exoplanets. So we've now detected something like, as of last count, about slightly over 4,000 believable candidate planets around other stars. And with that number of detections, we can build pretty robust statistics. And the robust statistics tell us that the number of planets roughly the size of the Earth and orbiting their stars at a distance where conceivably you could have a nice climate, where you could have liquid water on the surface of the planet, and liquid water we think is important for biochemistry as we understand it. If you run the numbers, then what you find is that within something like 15 to 20 light years of us, where there are, certainly within that distance there are many stars, we think that at least one of those stars, just based on the statistics, should have a Earth-sized planet and an orbit around its star where, in principle, it could be a lot like the Earth.
And, of course, we have one of those in our solar system. As you mentioned earlier, we have Mars, and Mars has not fared as well as we have, at least in terms of our bias toward valuing life.
Yeah, so Mars is still a puzzle. Obviously, exploration of Mars is still happening, and it's happening in a far more sophisticated way than it ever has before. NASA has its Curiosity rover on the surface of Mars. There are orbital platforms studying the composition of the atmosphere and the structures on the ground. And the conundrum with Mars is that we see plentiful evidence for liquid water having been on the surface of Mars in the past. What we don't know is how often that happened, or whether Mars once really had an environment more similar to that of the Earth. And we're talking several billion years ago now. Because if it did, that would be wonderful. That would mean that Mars was kind of an early starter and a quick finisher in the planetary stakes. And part of the reason for that is it's a slightly different composition to the Earth. It's obviously a smaller planet. The types of rocks it has, the type of geophysics Mars has, are different than the Earth. It may reflect Earth in the future at some level. It may be a planet which has run its course in terms of geophysics and conceivably in terms of life. So it's a fascinating place. We're again, not to say anything too significant about this, but we're really lucky that we have a planet like that in our solar system that may give us clues to our own origins.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Ray on the line in Hearst. Hello, Ray.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, I was wondering if the author was familiar with Roger Penrose's recent book and his theories about a cyclical universe. And if not, we could just talk about cyclical universes for a moment. I know there's the brain collision theory, and then Penrose put forth an idea that in the universe in the far, far future, after the expansion forces have fully acted upon it and the particles have all expired, then the universe can start over again just by accident.
What do you think, Caleb?
Well, I think Roger Penrose is a very, very bright guy, and he comes up with some very interesting ideas. I think his cyclical universe is definitely an interesting idea. What's rather nice about it, I am not intimately familiar with what he's written about it, but I do know that he has shown that there is a prediction. There's a prediction for a phenomena that we might be able to detect for astronomers to look at to do with what's called the cosmic microwave background. This is radiation left over from very close to the Big Bang, a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang, that we can still detect, and it gives us insight to what happened in the early universe. Now, Roger has said that there should be an imprint, or there could be an imprint, due to this cyclical universe idea in that radiation, and we might be on the cusp of having enough sensitivity to see it. Beyond that, it's a little outside my pay grade, I'm afraid.
What do you think would be different about the experience of life on Earth if we had definitive evidence that life existed elsewhere, even if we knew we could never make contact?
Well, I think there's two aspects to that. There's the pure scientific impact of knowing that there is life, for example, around a planet, around another star. That would change dramatically our understanding of the abundance of life everywhere. Just one other data point would dramatically improve our ability to say something about how likely it is for life to emerge in the universe. And that speaks to deep questions about how easy it is for life to originate. And if we knew that life, for example, could originate quite easily, that actually is a big clue. That might help us narrow down the options for the details, for the actual details of how that first bit of self-replicating chemistry got going on Earth. If we understood that it could happen in a slightly different environment and we knew something about that environment, that would give us more information about disentangling that problem. So that's one piece of it. That's the pure scientific piece, which is tremendously exciting. It's so incredibly important. The other piece, of course, is to do with our psyche, our outlook on the cosmos. And the consequence or the what would happen as a result of learning that there are other organisms somewhere else, I think that's hard to predict. And I know I've speculated about this. I've written about this at various points. One could be hopeful. One would like to think that it might make us take a good look in the mirror and see that, well, we are just one species. We're lucky to be here. Evolution has popped us out. It needn't have happened necessarily. What are we going to do about that? Maybe we should behave a little bit better. I would hope that would be the outcome. But it could go the other way. You know, the existence of life elsewhere could disturb us enough that some bad things happen. I would hope that isn't the case, but you never know.
How important is it to you and your colleagues to keep up with experiments taking place in laboratories trying to synthetically generate life? In other words, to make it sort of spontaneously happen the way it might have happened at the very dawn of life on Earth?
I think those experiments are extremely important. I think perhaps we haven't appreciated just how important they are until quite recently, because in searching for life in the universe, for example, suppose we find planets that are in every other respect spot on for the conditions that we think should give rise to life, but there's no evidence of life there. What are we going to do? How are we going to figure that out? And I think we will have to turn to our laboratories. And, you know, there's a, I guess it's an old adage, if you can build it, you can understand it. If we can build life in the lab, we may have a shot at understanding its origins better. And people are working hard on this, approaching it in a number of different ways. Some people are trying to do it from bottom up. So they're trying to mix together things like amino acids and catalysts and see what emerges in conditions that might represent what the conditions were on the early Earth. Other people are trying to construct entire cellular organisms from scratch, and in doing so, understand something about the nature of those organisms, but also to disentangle the evolution from this, because evolution is a kind of chaotic thing. It doesn't necessarily follow any sort of path. It follows, you know, natural selection creates evolution, and it can go in many different trajectories. And disentangling that is important, too, for asking questions which actually go back to something we talked about earlier, which is this idea of the anthropic principle. That what is it about our universe exactly that allows life to appear? We understand that you need carbon, and so you need certain physical characteristics of the universe for that. But what about more fundamental things? What about quantum mechanics? What about the deeper nature of matter? Is that a piece of this? How connected is it? And it may be in the lab that we can ask those questions. They're pretty blue sky questions, but they're really interesting.
Caleb Scharf is director of astrobiology at Columbia University. His new book is called The Copernicus Complex: Our Cosmic Significance in a Universe of Planets and Probabilities. Caleb, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
You're very welcome.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and Lindsay Connect. Engineer today was Alan Roberts, with help on the phones from Pablo Arauz Pena. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.